This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Let's take the Common Core global, people. I mean, the Tea Party already thinks it's a UN thing.
It's not.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Ted Cruz of Education Policy, Michael Brickman.
No, come on, man. Ted Cruz, I mean, he went to Harvard and everything, but I don't know. Not now.
I thought you would like that, Brickman. You're a conservative Republican. You come out of the Scott Walker office. I figure you're one of these Ted Cruz people. He's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, right?
He's radioactive right now. I don't know. I got away from all the political stuff. I'm here in policy land now. It's nice and safe.
Right. That's good. That's fair. That's fine. That's right. Policy land. You know, Ted Cruz, I have to admit that I had an image in my mind of what he looked like. I've been watching much TV lately, and so I mostly read the news. And then finally I saw him, and he does look a little bit like Mr. Smith. I mean, he looks kind of unassuming. Like, he doesn't look like the, you know, I figure a guy, Texas, a kind of pictured a, you know, cowboy hat, boots, rough talking. He's a Canadian. What? How did this happen?
I don't know, but we should definitely vote for our politicians based on what they look like. I've always said that.
Yes, so I think that is usually a good way to go. Absolutely.
Smart.
Okay, lots to cover. We are in full swing here in education reform land, policy land, as Brickman likes to say. Pamela, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Los Angeles and North Carolina have both encountered problems with their high-profile tablet programs. In LA, students managed to hack the tablet security filters, and the school board is scheduled to review the policy later this month. And in North Carolina, the tablets are reported to have defects, leading to the program suspension. Does this bode ill for the future of tablets in schools?
Boy, this is shocking. You couldn't see this coming, could you, Brickman?
Good for those kids. I want to meet these kids and shake their hand and then put them in a computer science class, because yes, that is awesome. That is something they should be doing, is getting around these tablet protections. I mean, that's so cool.
Wait, now so they hack it. What does this mean? Is this that the tablets were designed to not allow them basically to get just access to the internet or to porn and all that kind of stuff?
My guess is they probably did something similar to like jailbreaking an iPhone, where you can put your own apps and software and probably cheat on your tests and things like that.
Okay. So. All right. So yeah, so we give them credit for being entrepreneurial.
Absolutely.
You know, we always like to say, you know, we have this debate around here about, you know, how is it that American kids, we do so bad on these international tests, and yet we still are the most innovative entrepreneurial country in the world, you know, leading economic growth. It's this sort of behavior. It's this disrespect for authority that is so strong in America.
Yeah, it's the creativity that schools should actually be tapping into, not just trying to squelch at every opportunity.
There you go. So here's our new opinion here at Fordham. We support the Common Core. We also support hacking the Common Core.
Hack the Common Core, new
hack
hashtag.
The Common Core. All right. Over in North Carolina, I think it was that the tablets broke, literally, right? They were cracking, things like this. Again, this seems predictable. All this to say, look, I'm friends with some of the guys who are involved in these technology companies. And, you know, I mean, eventually it makes sense. We need to make this transition from textbooks to digital, right? I mean, that's going to happen. It eventually will save money. It eventually will mean that we'll have better curricular materials, right? And somebody's got to be out there on the leading edge, taking these risks and making mistakes.
Well, I think this is just the 21st century version of something that's been going on in school districts for years and years and years, where it's just absolute reckless mismanagement of funds. I mean, in the first place, the LA tablets, I think they paid higher than retail price, and they bought like tens, if not hundreds of thousands of these things.
Right.
And it's just what goes on. And these are the same people who say, we need more money, we don't have enough money to do what we're doing.
Yep.
Yet they completely don't manage their finances appropriately.
By the way, that sounded very Scott Walker-ish right there. Okay, topic number two.
Bill de Blasio, the Democratic candidate for mayor of New York City, has indicated that he would toss out Bloomberg's policy of not charging rent to charter schools. In response, 17,000 parents, students, and teachers marched across the Brooklyn Bridge in support of charter schools and Bloomberg's education policies. But does de Blasio have a point? Why don't charters pay rent in New York City?
Because the rent's too damn high.
It is. Rent is expensive in New York. I thought D.C. was bad, but was just up there for Education Nation, and I have some friends up there, and it is absolutely crazy. But I don't know. I think they probably shouldn't pay rent. They're public schools. It's mm-hmm. a public building. I think that's probably fair. But actually, I mean, look, de Blasio is going to win. It's pretty, he's not going to win by a little bit. And it's, what's actually scarier to me is shutting down access to charter school facilities, period. I think there are a lot of charter schools that are willing to pay market rent, but they're nervous about having to jump through a bunch of hoops or just being shut out of these buildings altogether.
You know, it is true. De Blasio will say, hey, in other cities, charter schools have to pay rent. And that is true. Problem is that takes a big bite out of their budgets, right? And again, public schools don't pay rent in the same way, right? We don't even account for their facilities costs in terms of, you know, the debt services and the things that they might be paying on their buildings. That's all on different lines. So when we're talking about, you know, national averages of now $12,000 per kid and spending, that doesn't even count the facilities, right? So I do think in these big cities especially, we need to get to the point where somebody other than the public school system owns these buildings, runs these buildings, and then they rent them out or lease them out or do something or offer them equally to the traditional public schools and to the charter schools. These are public schools. And the point is, if you make charter schools pay rent, then that's less money they have to do other things, like a longer school day, a longer school year, and they're already at a funding disadvantage. So look, I think the folks in New York have had it pretty good under Klein. There's no doubt about it. I think that's you know, under Klein, under Bloomberg, under now the new administration. But, you know, this is going to hurt if they have to pay significant rent. And, you know, this question about co-locations is again, about managing public resources. Do you want to have school buildings that are half empty, or do you want to make sure that all of your buildings in an expensive place like New York are filled to capacity? Maybe you can manage that process better than it's been managed at times, but, you know, we don't need to be turning away from this, because it is going to mean fewer charter schools. It's going to mean less access.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you make about how significant a reason this is. I mean, if de Blasio can point to a reason that is so significant that it's worth taking the resources away from education and, you know, putting them into the New York school district's coffers, if that's so important and he's got a really, really good reason for it, I'm willing to listen, but I don't think he does. This is about killing charter schools.
Absolutely. Okay, topic number three.
Earlier this week, Politico ran an article blasting voucher programs for having scant evidence of effectiveness in terms of academic gains for voucher recipients, pointing in particular to Milwaukee, where just 13% of voucher students scored proficient in math and 11% scored proficient in reading this spring. Brickman, I seem to recall you had a job of some sort in Wisconsin recently. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, we all know, and Adam had a great blog post on this, just pointing to how overwhelming the evidence is of voucher quality. And that's not to say across the board, there are some really crappy voucher schools out there. Can I say crappy on the air?
Sure.
Twice?
Yes, it's okay. Because it's really the internet, and instead of the air, and anything goes on the internet.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, but these are schools, some of these really low-performing schools, they need to be closed, just like the really low-performing public or charter schools need to be closed. And that's not to say, though, that overall vouchers aren't having an impact. They are having an impact.
Yeah.
And this is Politico just trying to kind of hide that evidence, not dissimilar from how right before the podcast, Mike spilled his coffee and tried to hide the spill under the cup. And did it work?
Well, it worked for a while. Yeah, but eventually it does not work over the long term.
The long term, the truth and the coffee
seeps out.
That's right.
Well said. Okay, so here's the... but look, this political argument... I mean, I like Stephanie Simon, the reporter. She has this investigative bent to her. She's hard-hitting, and I think we need that in the education space. But also seems pretty clear that she comes at things with a pretty left kind of perspective. She's, you know, very skeptical of any kind of privatization in education, and certainly against these vouchers. So this headline that says, you know, $1 billion going to voucher students now from public funding, right, with scant evidence of effectiveness. And what you say is, oh my gosh, this is one area in education policy where the evidence, as you say, is overwhelming, right? If you want to try to make the case that the evidence on vouchers is scant, oh my gosh, then we have nothing, you know, comes close to the evidence on vouchers, not preschool, right? Not charter schools, not many of the other things that we do, not spending more money on education, right? Not even class size reduction. I mean, any of those interventions, you know, when, first of all, they haven't been studied with gold standard trials as much as vouchers, or when they have, have. They have the same kind of results that you can try to shoot holes in. On the voucher side, every gold standard study that's been done, and there's been a lot of them, has showed positive results or neutral results. And some of the positive results, especially in grad rates, have been amazing, right? Through the roof, particularly for African-American kids. So, you know, this narrative, well, the evidence is mixed. It's not mixed. It's all positive or neutral. Right. That's not mixed. And by the way, $1 billion. OK, that sounds like a lot versus the, you know, $599 billion that goes into our traditional public school system.
Or and I was going to mention the $1 billion as well. That's an argument that drives me crazy, because I think in every case, these vouchers are less than would have been spent for those same kids had they gone to traditional public schools.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that is just such a disingenuous argument to say, look at this big price tag, when the price tag would be a lot higher if these kids were in the traditional public schools.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, there are legitimate arguments against vouchers. You can say, hey, I don't want public money going to fund religious schools. I understand people, I disagree with that, but I understand that argument. You could say that, you know, we don't want money going to schools that have selective admissions. Now, we do that in the public system too, in magnet schools. But again, I understand that argument. But you cannot in 2013 make the argument based on facts and say that vouchers have not been proven to show effectiveness. They have. They show effectiveness for the kids that are in these programs. That, I think, is you know, a fact at this point. There's no opinions about it anymore. So, you know, if Stephanie Simon or others want to make case against vouchers, they got to pick some other argument.
Totally agree.
All right. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, does it bother you? I have to admit, it bothers me that Ted Cruz, senator, right? He's like our age.
Isn't it weird? Why is that bothering you?
I don't know, because I'm old enough now to be the same age as a senator. Yeah. I don't know. That's kind of depressing to me.
Yeah, it is a little depressing. Right? Yeah. I was reading, well, maybe this is inappropriate, but I guess Miley Cyrus was saying folks after 40 didn't, you know, do it anymore. Did you hear this comment?
And I'm thinking, I did not.
Come on, 40, you know, senators, so I have no problem with
Well, not all of us are newlyweds, Amber, but that's another story. All right. Well,
yeah, anyway. Might be fodder for cutting out, but that just
But speaking of age, let's point out that it is the older Americans who did better on the test
the study
of literacy
that I'm going to talk about.
Oh, good segue. Yes. Okay, let's go, Amber. What you
all
got
right,
for us?
All right, it's a brand new inaugural edition of a new international study called Program for the International Assessment of Adult Competencies. Anyway, it's the PISA for old folks, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's surveying folks from age 16 to 65 in 24 countries. About 22 of them are OECD members. Bottom line, the U.S. performed below the international average on most measures. Researchers found that proficiency is closely related to age, peaking at around age, take a guess.
This is worldwide?
Uh-huh.
40?
30.
Ouch.
And declining steadily, with the oldest age groups displaying lower levels of proficiency than the youngest.
But not in America.
That said, older Americans stood out comparatively well in literacy. 12% of Americans 55 to 65 scored at the highest proficiency level, while internationally only 5% in that same age group did the same. But in every other age group, we lagged behind. Overall, roughly every fifth Finn chimed the checker joke, and Japanese read at the highest levels. Other countries who perform above average, Australia, Belgium, Canada, besides the U.S., much of Europe is below the international average. Some countries made significant progress over time and generations. For example, Korea is among the three lowest performing countries when examining proficiency for 55 to 65 year olds. However, among its 16 to 24 year olds, Korea ranks second only to Japan. Progress is uneven over time. So, you know, we can look at the U.S. again. Our older adults do better in literacy, but our younger adults, 16 to 24, do not. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of great sort of caveats in the report that, you know, are worth mentioning. One of which is it's not necessarily that our performance is declining, but progress in other countries is rising so much faster across mm-hmm. successive generations, and that's important. And also the quality of education could have changed over the decades, even within the same country. So you might have the same credential, but it doesn't really mean the same thing because you had a different experience in school. And keep in mind, this is not cross-sectional. So we're looking, I mean, it is cross-sectional. We're not looking and following these folks over time. So some of this could be just population differences. These populations are completely different. So anyway, it's a fascinating report. Just like all OECD reports, it's so long and so much that it's hard to just chunk it down, but it's worth trying to chunk it
down. That is why people come to you, Amber, for your research minute or two or three.
Two or three, right.
So this question about demographic change is important, and especially in the U.S. So we know that the demographics are much different when you're talking about 55 to 65-year-olds versus our younger people. The younger people are much more likely to be members of minority groups, especially Latinos, more likely to be lower income. You know, this is mostly the result of this huge influx of immigration that we've had in this country, the biggest influx, you know, since 100 years ago when my peeps came over from Italy and other places, right? So we've had this huge demographic change. Still, the bottom line is, and so you can say that to kind of say, well, it's not necessarily that our schools have gotten worse, right? But the point is still that the people who are retiring are being replaced by people with lower skills. And maybe 100 years ago, that didn't matter as much because we were in a, you know, quasi-industrial society. Problem is now the skills of our population matter a lot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're facing kind of a headwind here.
Yeah. Let me give you a data point that I didn't include because I like to be on time. So one of the things, it builds on this point. So actual skill levels differ from what the formal qualification might say. So in Japan, Japanese and Dutch 25 to 34-year-olds who have completed only high school outperform Italian and Spanish and some other kids of the same exact age. So in other words, you know, wow, you've got this piece of paper, and what does it mean in some of these places?
Right. Standards.
Right, exactly. Let's take the Common Core Global, people. I mean, the Tea Party already thinks it's a UN thing.
It's not.
All right, good joke. Fun one. Anyway. Wow. You know, so look, I don't understand, though, how people cannot be alarmed by some of this, right? And to say, again, it's not to beat up on our schools,
that's right.
Okay? But it's to say that we see other countries making rapid progress. And so the argument is we need to make rapid progress too.
That's right.
And
that's
even when you consider the demographic change, and that's an issue, but, you know, if you just look at our white populations or kids with college-educated parents, they're not doing great shakes either.
Right.
You know, so there's something going on here. It's not... You know, the message is not bad schools, you're failing. It's, hey, other countries are figuring out how to make great progress, and we need to push that progress
button
also.
And it's the cultural stuff, too. I mean, I hate to say that, but, right, do you think we're getting to a place? I mean, you go to Asia, and you see they value education.
Yeah.
Like, they just do. It's. Yeah. I mean, it's when you come out of the womb, you know, it's important. This is what we're, you know, this stuff is important to your life trajectory. And I don't know. I feel like it's still a sort of a cultural fight in this country to kind of elevate education to its proper place.
Well said. We'll let Amber have the last word on that. Okay, that is all the time for this week. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Until next week.
This is Michael Brickman.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.